Okay, it's 2:00. Let's get started. Are there any questions? Okay, you can all go away. Today's the day for questions. Yes? Oh, what a good question. Okay, so the question is, why are we bothering with this tree stuff? Why can't we just get away with using lists? So trees can represent many different things, right? You've seen trees used to represent propositions and expressions, for instance, and that's much harder to do with lists. But I think particularly you're talking about using trees to represent sets or maps, as we looked at last week and as was done in the tutorial last week. So, of course, you could represent a map just as a list of pairs rather than using a tree, but there's a big difference which you should have worked out from doing the lab, right? If you did it, if you had a million things in your map and you were given an example that had about that many, then you discover that it took about half a second if you were using a list, and that's because you had to look at a million entries in the list to see which one was right. Look at the first one, is it that? No. Look at the second one, and so on. With a tree, if you're using a properly balanced tree, then you get rid of half the entries each time. So instead of it taking a million steps to look at a million things, it takes about 20 steps to look at a million things. And for the people in my tutorials who measured it, they found it took about half a second to do things using a list. And what came out is 0.00 seconds using a tree, which means less than half of, less than 500ths of a second. So, no, less than 5,000ths of a second, sorry. So about 100 times faster. And actually, it's much faster than that, right? If you compare a million steps to 20 steps, that's, 50,000 times faster. And that's for a million, right? For 10 million, it's 10 million steps versus 30 steps. So, versus 13 steps. So there's a big difference in using trees because they're a lot faster. Now, very often, right, I've jumped up and down several times and said, don't worry about how fast it is. And very often, you know, who cares if it takes half a second? But if you're writing a server on the web and you've got millions of people doing it, then half a second per request to Google versus 5/1000ths of a second per request to Google is a huge difference. So sometimes you need to be able to make things faster. And then using trees instead of lists can be a big improvement. You have a follow-up question. Ah, well, the way lists are represented in Haskell, right, you can't randomly access the middle of the list. In a language like Java, you can, but not in Haskell. You'd need to use an array rather than a list. And Haskell does have arrays, but we've not taught you about them. So you could say, well, I want to use an array rather than a tree, and that's because you can use a sorted array to simulate a tree, but it's the same algorithm. Yes?
Is there a way to balance out the tree without rebuilding it completely?
Is there a way to balance the tree without rebuilding it completely? No, just rebuild it completely.
Well, from what I did on my PC, it took the list version to build in less than a second. It took 17 seconds to build the tree.
It took you 17 seconds to build the balanced tree versus 1 second to build a sorted list. So I'm surprised the difference was that large. But even if it is, if you're talking about building, say, a web service where you have millions and millions of requests, 17 seconds is easy. Right? And indeed, right, Google uses a tree-like structure for answering queries. And it does take them a long time to build this huge tree-like structure that's used for answering queries. But it doesn't matter. Right? They do it once a day. And then they get, you know, zillions of queries. So don't worry if it takes a long time to initialize something that's used only once.
Right. But still, V1 is slower in the seek time and worst case scenario access.
So the tree one was slower to look things up.
Yeah. 10 to 20 times slower.
Not the experiments my students performed. You can show me the details of that later, maybe. Usually I would, right, it's easy to work out that with a list it takes a million steps, and with a tree it takes about 20 steps. So you have to work really hard to get the tree to be slower.
I tried accessing the last element of the list, and it took 0.00 seconds.
For a million?
I accessed the middle one, and it took 0.01 seconds. And accessing the middle and the last element and so on, and the tree took...
Oh, so by last you mean first.
Right. Well,
middle shouldn't take longer than the last. Middle is halfway, last is all the way.
Well, I took the first one, last one, middle one. They all have roughly the same time for accessing.
Well, you said last took 0 seconds,
yeah.
And middle took 0.1.
0.02, 0.01.
Something bigger than zero.
Yeah.
Why did middle take longer than last? Yeah. So it would be a million steps to get the last and 500,000 to get the middle.
Yeah.
So middle should be more. Nope. Okay, we'll deal with it offline. But you have a serious question there, but we'll deal with it offline when you can show me your code. Okay. I saw one other hand near the front about something related to this. Somebody else had a hand up.
Could we use length function to find the middle, to split the list into two parts?
You're still on splitting the list into two parts. If you split the list into two parts, then define the middle. Well, the million's halfway down the list, right? So it's 500,000 elements. So it's going to take 500,000 steps to find the middle. Starting with the middle won't help if it's a list. If it's a tree, the middle's at the top of the tree. It'll help a lot. So trees are good. They can be a lot faster. When I say, let me just see a quick show of hands. When I say that a list of length 1,000,000 takes 1,000,000 steps, okay, I'll just check and see if people are raising their hands. Does everybody understand why a list of length 1,000,000 takes 1,000,000 steps? Yeah, hands up. Good, okay. You didn't raise your hand. Right, now, when I say that a tree takes 20 steps rather than 1,000,000 steps, do people understand why I'm saying that? Aha, you didn't raise your hand and you meant it this time. Okay, would you like me to explain? So at least some people aren't following it, and it is a bit tricky. So let me explain why this happens. So if you have a sort tree, right, you're going to put some element up here. And if something's less than the element, you look here. And if it's greater, you look there. So far, so good? Good. So if you had 1,000,000 elements here, you'd have 500,000 here and 500,000 here. Okay. Now I want to actually get to the end of this. So instead of picking 1,000,000, I'm going to pick 64. So you've got 64 things in the tree. And roughly speaking, there's an off by one error here, but it doesn't matter too much. After doing the split, you've got 32 and 32, right? Yep. So after we do the split again, we have 16 and 16. Okay. How many steps is it going to take to reach the bottom of the tree? Two? Well, we're still at 16. We've still got 16 things to choose between. Right, but how many more steps will it take? After one more step, what have we got left? Right, how many steps does it take to reach the bottom of this tree, roughly? Six. Why six? Because 2 to the power of 6 is 64, or put another way, 6 is log base 2. Let me try to write my 2 so it's readable. 6 is log base 2 of 64. All right, so we'd have 8 here, 4 here, 2 here, 1 here. So to get it down to single elements, it takes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 steps. And in general, right, if you had 1,000,000, it would be log base 2 of 1,000,000, which you can work out on your calculators is 20. And log base 2 of 1,000,000,000 is 30. Right? Every factor of 1,000 gives you about 10 steps because 2 raised to the 10th power is 1,024. Yes? Yes.
But if we have a balanced tree, but for example, if it would be the first element, it would take like one step. Like if we want to get 18 in our list of 1,000,000, 18 happens to be the first one, takes one step.
Right.
But in a balanced tree, it would take more than one step, wouldn't it?
That's right.
So that's maybe why he has different speeds for different things, because I had the same thing in the program, in the tree.
Well, certainly there will, it's always, for a certain number of elements, right, things might be faster with the tree. But what you care about is the average speed, usually. Sometimes you might care about the minimum speed. Right, but there will be some elements in a list for which it takes 1,000,000 steps, which is huge. Right, if you can make everything be at most 20 steps, then that's much, much better. Notice that this is true even if each step, right? Maybe looking at one element of a list just takes three machine instructions, whereas looking at one element of a tree takes 20 machine instructions. You're still much better off with a tree, because 20 times 20 is 400 instructions, whereas 3 times a million is 3 million instructions. So you don't need to worry about how many instructions each individual step takes, as long as it's a certain fixed number, what we call a constant factor. But you, what you do need to worry about how many steps in general you're taking. And the difference between linear and logarithmic is huge. So again, you don't need to worry about this all the time, but you do need to know about it in those cases where you're really doing something a lot and you want to make it fast. Yes?
How would you go about balancing a tree?
Very good question. Check me out if I'm right. This is covered in the textbook, right? The textbook has some examples of how to build balanced trees? Yes. So you can look it up in the textbook. I'm not going to do it in class because I will. It's actually tricky enough that I will get it wrong if I do it off the top of my head. But there's standard techniques for doing that. And of course, it is important in general to make the tree balanced because, you know, on average, at random, it will come out balanced. But it's quite helpful to have techniques that guarantee that it's balanced.
Steps are important, 20 steps for a million elements. That's assuming a perfectly balanced tree then.
That's not perfectly balanced, but at least balanced, right? Because in fact, right, if you just say, oh, well, just always put the element, right, the naive insert algorithm that we gave when we discussed it in class, if you always give it, if you give it the elements in sorted order, right, well, we'll put the first element at the root and the next element after that and the next element after that, you'll get a completely unbalanced tree, which would be horrible. So you need to be at least roughly balanced. There are actually various definitions of roughly balanced, like each side. So the depth of the tree is the number of nodes you can go down. You did examples of computing depth. A tree that's balanced enough is as long as any two subtrees have a depth within one of each other. So they don't need to have exactly the same depth, but if it's within one, that'll be close enough. Okay. Very good questions about trees. Okay. So there's some specific questions I'm going to invite today. There's a specific thing that I want to look at doing. But before that, I'll deal with announcements. So just a few. First of all, do you all realize that the mock exam has been delayed from this week to next week? Have you all received an announcement about that? Okay, you should have all had email about that. So the time you signed up for this week, go next week instead. If you can't do that for some reason, let the ITO know and they will change to a time that you can make. I apologize for the change. It's because we use a special bit of software on the exam machines when you're using them for an exam to make sure, you know, right? Normally a computer is a communication device, right? You can use the internet to communicate with lots of other people, including your friend to say, hey, what's the answer to this exam question? Now for the mock exam, that doesn't really matter, but for the final exam, of course it does. So that the mock exam is like the final exam, you use this lockdown software that makes sure that you can't use the computer as a communication device, that you don't have access to the internet. And of course, we want to make sure that that software runs reliably. So it's very well tested. And recently, we changed the operating system used on the machines in the labs. And it's not been tested thoroughly with the new operating system. So that's what the extra week is for, is to make sure that things will run smoothly. And we're sorry that we didn't work out that this problem would happen in advance, but that's the reason for the delay. Yes? You can use any editor that you want. Yes? So will you have? Ah, right. So pretty much the only way we can reliably turn off the internet is to turn off all of it. So the bits of the internet that are very helpful for looking at bits of Haskell, no, you don't get access to those either. Except there's one library called, bit of documentation called Zvon, which we take a copy of. And there's a pointer to the Zavon material on the home webpage for Informatics One. So we'll make that one available to you, and that's described on the webpage if you want to see what it looks like in advance. All right, we're not trying to make you memorize libraries, right? We also give you a listing of the libraries just like for the class exam. But we can't give free access to everything. Right. So, yes?
Do we have access to our own files? Because my husband's book is in digital format.
Do you have access to your own files? No. Sorry. It's difficult to do that because, again, the file system could actually be used as a means of communication. That's one of the major reasons for doing that. As I recall, it says on the webpage that the exam is closed book. Right, so the answer is no. You have to know the material in the book well enough. And that's mainly because if you don't know the material in the book well enough when you walk into the exam, you won't have time to assimilate it during the exam. So if somebody feels that there's something that they really want notes on that they're not getting through Zavon, that they think is reasonable to have provided because they don't want to have to memorize it, let me know and we'll see what we can do about that. But the idea is not to make you memorize stuff. Right? You should learn how to use proper documentation. The idea is just to have a uniform set that everybody has access to. Okay. So that's about the mock exam. Two other things I want to mention. One is there, how many people know what the initials IRC means?
Internet Relay Chat. Right.
So IRC indeed stands for Internet Relay Chat. And what that is just a program where you can type things in and it's broadcast to everybody else that's logged into what's called the same IRC channel. And there's a channel that's there for the Informatics One class. And for instance, the TAs often log into that and just listen to see if there are any queries. And the other students are often logged in to see. So we've talked about various methods of getting help. One method of getting help available to you is IRC. So if you go to the Informatics One FP webpage, there's a little link to the IRC channel at the bottom of the page, and you can use that to log in. How many people have been using the IRC channel? Right, so you can see that there are quite a few people who have been using it, and it'll be even more valuable if more of you use it. So I thought I'd remind people that it's there. Money. So every year, as part of Informatics One, we run a contest. If you've looked at this week's tutorial, you'll have seen it described there. So the exercise this week is to do graphics involving something called L systems, which are fractal graphical diagrams. So it's a fun exercise using recursion to generate recursive pictures. You can either use that or use any other Haskell graphics you want to create an interesting picture. So it's a very open-ended contest. The rule is create an interesting picture using Haskell. The deadline is going to be 4 p.m. next Thursday. This is to give us a little bit of time to evaluate them before the final presentations in the last week, which is the following week. You can submit by just sending an email to either of the TAs for the course, or preferably just copy it to both of them. And of course, their emails are on the webpage. It's important to actually stick to this as a strict deadline, because you'll all know people will tend to do more work towards the deadline, and we want to give everybody the same amount of time. If you look on the web page, you will see entries in past year's competitions, and you will see that there have been some quite a wide range of things done. Some people do very simple things. Some people do very elaborate and very impressive things. All of them, I think, are worth doing. Right? The most important thing from this is you don't need to just do the work that was assigned to you. You can figure out something interesting to do and do it on your own. And just doing that, I think, carries a great deal of value. And then you'll see that many people have really gotten carried away with that and done very impressive things. So there's been so much impressive work that for the last couple of years, we've actually given 7 prizes. A first prize of a book token of £20, 2 second prizes of £10, and 4 third prizes of £5. I'm not saying we will do that this year. It will depend on what sort of entries we get. But if they're consistent with what we've had the previous years, we will do something quite similar. The money for these book tokens comes from Galois, which is a programming firm located in Portland, Oregon, founded by one of the original designers of Haskell, John Launchbury. And it was sort of devoted to the, well, if this functional programming is so good, we should be able to make lots of money by offering people contract programming and doing it in Haskell instead of any of these other languages that people use. We believe Haskell is so much better than these that we could make more money by just doing programming in Haskell. So they're devoted to that idea. And they pretty much, if you're a good Haskell programmer and you want to sit down spending your time writing programs, they are very good people to hire you because they have a lot of the best Haskell programmers in the world working there. Although actually the person who I consider to be the best Haskell programmer in the world now doesn't work there, he works at a bank. Right, because banks are also hiring functional programmers. Any number of people can work on an entry. The only important thing is just list all the names of everybody who contributed to the entry when you send it in. And that's where you can find the previous entries. Just go to the home page and it'll be easy to find. I think that's what I want to say about that. Any questions about the competition? So each year we've had maybe a third of the class participated. I strongly encourage you all to participate. As I say, just doing anything that's not actually what we've assigned you is a great thing to do. Just set your own limits and choose what you want to do. Oh, this isn't working very well. This thing is slow. Wake up. Try again. There we go. Okay. So I do have material prepared for this week. I think we'll go through most of that tomorrow. What I want to spend some time on, and this will depend on how much time you guys want to spend, is going over the class exam and what questions you had about the class exam. And the reason for doing that is we've been going through quite a clip at different material, and I know that some people are just right on top of that, and that other people are lagging behind. So I'm very happy to have a wide range of questions about anything you want having to do with basic programming, and particularly focused on answers to the class exam. The other thing that I want to do, this will wake people up, is show you how to pass the final. Okay? Because there's a very simple trick that nobody has ever done. I'm amazed that nobody ever does this. So I thought, well, all right, I'll just show them. It's completely obvious, but I'll show them anyway. Okay? So this is how you pass the final exam. Right? This is why we give it to you on a computer. It's why when you get the exam, it's on a PDF on the computer. You can actually exploit that. I will show you how. So let's look at, let's see, can I, oh, I know what I need to do, sorry. Let's just get this at a size we can look at it. There you go. So here's the class exam. And let's just look at the first question. Write a function f from character to integer that converts its character to its score. And then you remember there were complicated rules about what the score for a character is. How many people can ace this question? Good, your hand didn't go up. Do you want to ask a question about it? Who wants to ask a question about this? Who'd like to see my favorite solution to it? Lots of you, okay. So let's pull up an editor here. Let's see. Let's quit that. Okay, so we're going to do the exam. We need to write a function f, going from a character to an integer. And let's see, if it's a character in the first half of the alphabet, it scores, if it's in the second half, it scores twice as much if it's in the first half. If it's capital, it scores twice as much as if it's lowercase. Did I get that right? Or is it the other way around? Triple, three times as much. Hold on. Let's have a look. This will tell me. First half of the alphabet, right, twice as much if it's in the second half, three times as much if it's uppercase. So there are various ways of doing that. But, oops. So is first needs to give us the score depending whether it's in the first half of the alphabet or the second half. So the first half is A dot M. Let's see. Is upper is actually defined, right? So let's call this first score or half score. Because is upper is the name of the existing predicate. Sorry? Half score. Thank you. What we can do is lower in 1 and 3. That'll be better. It's actually which half and which case, so we'll call it case score. And then we want to check if that works, right? Excuse me. Yep.
In the half score function, all the uppercase letters will get score too, because...
Shh. So let's see if that works. How do we see if it works? Okay, well, the easy way to do it, right, the first thing you should do is run a shell, say GHCI exam, okay, and let's just try it, right, because it told us what the answer should be. That's the important thing. It tells you what the answer should be, right? We can, oh, where'd it go? It tells us, right? F of little a should be 1, F of big A should be 3. Let's find out. Not what I want to do. There we go. So let's see, F of little a is 1, good. F of big A is 6. Let's see, that wasn't what it said, was it? It said F of big A should be 3, and we're getting 6. F of little a was right. And let's just check the other two. F of little z is 2. F of big Z is 6. So F of big A was wrong. Quite a few, who spotted what the bug was? Quite a few of you did, I think. Right. So your hand was up first. What was? Right. So the trick, the thing that went wrong here, is, right, we're counting lowercase letters from A to M as being in the first half, but it needs to be either a lowercase or an uppercase letter. So there are various ways of doing that. One way to do it is just before checking, convert to lowercase. Another way to do it is to check separately for the first half for upper and lowercase. Let's see if this one fixes it. So now, whoops, we need to reload it. Now it gives the right thing. Let's check the other ones. And let's check the little a still is the right thing. Okay, so there we go. We might check some other things, right? Does it do the right thing for little m and big M and little n and big N? Those are what we would expect, so that's okay. Okay. But there's a much better, easier way of getting the computer to do the work for you. And that's what I wanted to show you. Can anybody think of what it is? Yeah? We could use quick check in something like a property function. Now that's for doing random testing, and we'll look at doing random testing in a minute, but we don't really know. What property would you write?
Oh, I was looking at the answer for the class exam. I know it was had F, the prop F, which would be the scores for the examples that are given.
Right, so I did it with a, yep. You could use HUNIT for unit testing. So the idea is let's find some way of getting Haskell to do things for us. And the easiest way doesn't involve using anything like quick check or HUNIT or anything like that. Let's just write a Haskell function that checks that the answers for those cases are correct. Okay. So I'll show you how to do that. Look, we've got the cases right here. Let's just select them. Right, let's see, Adobe Reader Tools, select tool. Okay, I've now selected, whoops, can we get, yeah, that piece of text, Control C. Let's go back to our program. Let's write something called test. Paste! Well, we need to turn this into a legal Haskell program, but that's easy. Whoops. There, is that the legal Haskell program we want?
No.
Not quite. What do we need to do to fix it? Right, equals is, right, checking if two things are the same is double equal. There we go. Okay, so we've got our test program. Let's go back. Let's reload. Oh, not happy. Lexical error in line 10. Let's go see what that was. Oh, so they do. Thank you. Well, I hadn't realized that. Now it works. There we go. Did four tests for us at once. Now there are a couple of real advantages here. Because you used cut and paste, you can't mistype any of the test cases. Okay? And because you stuck it in the program, then every time you change the program, it's easy to do the same tests again. Right, so let's say you want to make a change to the program to improve it, and you want to make sure you didn't break anything. So for instance, one thing it actually says is, well, really you should define your program so that it's undefined if you give it something that's not a letter. If you look at it, it's not quite right like that yet. We should really make it so that if you give it something that's not a letter, neither of those things work. So an easy way to do that would be to say, well, it should only be defined if X is alphabetic. In that case, I want to return the product of these two things. Let's see if that change, let's just check that that change didn't break anything. Yay, it still works. So it's very easy to take the test cases and put them into your code and make use of that each time. Trivial. One person for the class exam, where they didn't have a computer available to run things, actually did this of the two tutorials worth that I marked, which was great, and which was amazing to me because I've marked whole final exams where nobody has done this. Or maybe they did it and erased it. Possibly. So, I will now jump up and down. Do this! If you do it, don't erase it. If you do it and you don't erase it, I will see it and smile. Not only will I smile, but if you don't get the test perfect, if you don't get the question perfect, I will give you partial credit for having tried to test the thing. Okay? Put in evidence showing that you tested it, and you will get partial credit. Okay? This is academia trying to reflect real life. Right? If you work in real life as a developer, testing is a huge amount of what you do. Real companies that produce real software pay huge amounts of money to people just to do testing. Question? You mean now that you know that's worth something? You don't need to declare types for Haskell, you can. Right, let's call test 1A, because it's the test of part 1A. If you want to declare a type, you may do so. Okay? So let's go on and just do the rest of the question. Right, so the rest of it was, given a list of characters as a string, find the sum of the scores for all the letters in the string, dropping out everything else. Right? So I hope most of you know how to do that by now. Right? Use F to find the score for each X in the string such that it's a letter. And then we want to add them all together. That's how you do it with comprehensions. You can also do it with recursion, right? What are the two cases for recursion? Nil cons. What's the sum of the empty list going to be? Right, it's zero, I will remind you. Many people write that instead. They think, oh, empty list must be empty list. No, empty list gives us the sum of the empty list, which is zero. And recursively, right, find the value for F, find the value, recursively find the value for the tail, and then add them together. Okay? Right, so what's the first thing we should do? Look at the text. There are two examples here. GAZZ returns 12, and this other thing returns 6. Let's put those in. Right, so this is our test for 2B. So by returns 12, right, we mean it's equal to 12. By and, we mean and. Let's try that. Test 2B. Yay! Okay, and then we need a test 2C. Let's move test 2B where it belongs. Right, and test 2C is just doing the same thing with H instead. Yep, let's call test 2C. And test 2C. Oh! Oh dear. Exception, non-exhaustive pattern. Okay. Right, several people noted when I wrote this down what was wrong with it. What's wrong with it? Right. This one only found the sum of those things that were alphabetic. This one finds the sum of everything. Right, so to fix it, if it's alphabetic, add it in. And otherwise, what do we do? Right, we don't add it in. We just find the sum of the remaining alphabetic scores. Yay. Okay. Now, I wanted to make that mistake because you could see how natural it was to just forget to put in that guard, right? The problem said clearly, test that it's alphabetic. And notice this is why in the first problem it says, make it an error if it's not alphabetic, because then when you test, you would find the error exactly the way I did. Right, score is not defined for things that aren't alphabetic, so make it return an error if you give it something that's not alphabetic. That's called defensive programming. It means that your testing is more likely to reveal errors. It's a huge amount of the credit for the question to do this. Right, that's one of the things we're testing on. If you forget to do it, we don't know that you know how to do it, so we can't give you credit for it. So it's really important to pay attention to what the questions say and do that, rather than doing something different and especially something simpler. So do keep in mind what the question is asking and making sure to do all parts of that. That's one of the most common errors, is for people to just leave off little bits like that. And now, here's the last thing, right? The questions are a bit artificial, right? The questions are carefully designed. If you look at the final exam, you'll see the first question always has the same form. It's the same thing, done three times. First time with comprehensions, as here, as for G. Second time with recursion, as for H, here. And third time, you didn't get this on the class exam, but you will on the final, do it with higher order functions. By the way, what higher order functions means is things like, and you're told specifically which ones you can use, map, filter, and fold. And it's very careful. It says you can use any, don't use any other library functions except for basic functions. And you'll get two diagrams, one showing you basic functions and one not. That's important because isAlpha is a basic function but not a library function. So it's perfectly fine to use isAlpha when using higher order, which you want to do, right? You want to filter with that. Let's actually do, what comes after H? I. Of course, H is best because it's higher order, but right. How would you do it with higher order functions? It'd be fold R plus and zero. Oh, let's really do it higher order, right? Map F filter isAlpha. So I there should be the same. Let's just